So
this was something he was doing for his dissertation, or was it just a practice experiment?
No, this was part of this program that I mentioned on hypervalent sulfur compounds that he was engaged in. He was trying to study the generation of these and their subsequent chemistry. Mm-hmm. And it was in the course of that study, which was the topic of his PhD dissertation, that he had made this observation. And as a result of that observation then, by careful work, we were able to discern an unusual product. By discerning an unusual product, we then made a hypothesis as to how that unusual product might have arisen. By having that hypothesis, then, we were able to generate in a much more straightforward and conventional way the kind of reagent that we would need. In fact, we then made, and then a subsequent student, this was then, it starts growing into a pretty large project now, and so it's not within the confines of a single PhD thesis. So then a second student took up this program, and he then made a defined reagent, and then began exploring this reagent, and it did everything that we had hoped it would do. And this initiated another area of research that continued in our laboratories even to this day.
It's unexpected.
And, well, the initial observation was unexpected.
Yeah. And now, where do you, I'm just trying to picture how it works out. He sees something that's unusual and he calls you in. Is that right? And says, what can this be?
Well, it's not as dramatic as that. In chemistry, one tends to work fairly closely with the students. So this means that on a very regular basis, one sits down and talks with the students about what they've been doing.
Once a day or once a week?
At that time, it would be once a day.
Uh-huh.
At this time now, I don't have quite that much time available to see everybody once a day, so it would be more commonly once a week.
Mm-hmm.
But at this time in my career, I was seeing each of my students at least once a day.
Do they come in here, or do you go to their desk?
No, I always go
desk
to the lab. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's much, much more important to be in the lab where things are happening and mm-hmm. where all the data is to be able to talk.
Mm-hmm.
So I always have my consultations with my students in the labs and where they're working.
Do others listen in?
Sometimes, but most of the time it's a one-on-one type activity. So on occasion when there is a closeness of projects, sometimes we'll get together with two or three. But in the group, we tend to have each student more or less operating on their own program. And as a result of each student operating on their own program, it's more appropriate just to talk with each one individually.
Yeah.
And I think it's also important for the students that they do get individual attention and don't feel that they're only part of a group, so that they have an opportunity to really express their frustrations when they have them. And there's a lot more frustration than success in research.
Uh-huh.
And so the few times that you really have a success and you can feel the elation of that has to hold you for those many, 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 many more times when you just have one frustration after another.
Do you feel this frustration too, or do you see that in fact it's all going to come out right?
Oh no, I feel the frustration just as much as my students, and sometimes more so, because I can see projects which are not making any progress for reasons which may not be scientifically related. Students are human. They have the same kinds of problems as anyone else. And you see sometimes programs just languish because the person is going through some hard time. And they're not, they're perhaps not really into their program with the kind of intense effort, mental as well as physical effort, that is necessary really to move the program ahead. And it's sort of just hovers there and it doesn't move in any direction.
And this is hard on you. It's important to you that this particular project be accomplished in terms of other things you're doing or just on behalf of the student?
Oh, it's both. Both on behalf of the student, because it's extremely important for their career that their program move ahead at a reasonable rate, but also important to me as well, in the sense that our ability to raise funds to carry out research depends on whether we are productive in our research or not. Mm-hmm. If we are productive, then we will get the support that's necessary. If we're not going to be productive in our research, then we're not going to get the support that's necessary. So the very support base of our group depends on the success of the group.
Yes. So the students are all dependent on each other in that respect, too,
oh,
in
yes.
a way.
It's a small community that is very, very interdependent. One works very, very closely. And it is a joint collaboration between the students and the faculty person. While the students are the ones who are actually doing the physical experiments, and they are also, hopefully, if they're good students, contributing a great deal to the intellectual development of the program, the faculty member is providing a lot of that intellectual contribution, providing the initial seed of the idea in almost all cases, as well as providing the critical insight, stimulation, analysis to move the programs ahead, to help teach the student how you go about doing research properly, and to make sure that they develop tendency to observe things that may not seem to be important, because as you've already seen, we have several instances where it's these chance observations that have become a major focus.
Which might have escaped
if one
had done kind of student's attention, is that right?
Right. If you had done things somewhat more superficially, then these are some of the kinds of things that one could very, very easily miss, totally miss. And in the past, we didn't have as many powerful tools to study such things as we do at present. And so one has a better opportunity now with these tools to be able to do a more proper job and hopefully be able to discover more things as a result of that.
Are you always confident that you will be able to help the student? Would it happen sometime that you yourself can't see what's going wrong? I mean, is this ever a problem?
Oh, of course. In any kind of research, there is never a 100% guarantee that a particular project will come to a successful conclusion. There are always those shares of problems that don't get finished because you don't really, you run into some obstacles and you don't see a way around those obstacles.
Mm.
And in cases like that, what sometimes happens is that you come back to them. You go through the process of being able to try your best, reach the obstacle. This might lead to the end of a student's career in the group. In other words, they might have gotten, you know, they've reached a point where we really can't solve the problem, but they've done a nice job, and so if they're a graduate student, they'll have their PhD thesis. Or if it's a postdoctoral student, of course, they would be leaving in any event. But then several years later, a new thought might come into your mind based on developments that have happened in the interim. And you might say, hey, that's exactly what we needed to know to solve that problem, and then come back to that problem and reinitiate it, and perhaps successfully. Sometimes even then, not successfully. So there certainly is many, many cases, more than one would like to admit, that did not end up successfully. That's, again, part of doing research.
Can you give another example, like the one you gave on the sulfur?
I could give an illustration of yet another area, which in this case, it was not by happenstance, but by design, where we were running into one of these obstacles that I had just referred to. We were trying to carry out a total synthesis of an insect molting hormone, actually. And in exploring this particular strategy to this insect molting hormone, we came into a synthetic problem, which we had assumed, based on literature analogy, could be accomplished by known methods. And when we came to this particular operation to carry out this structural modification, we tried virtually all of the various methods that were known in the literature and just were unable to satisfactorily resolve the problem. Now, there is a case where, fortunately, the student who has undertaken this program, we were able to try to think of alternative ways which were not in existence in order to achieve this goal. And we designed, again, based on some understanding of things that were published in the literature, a way of doing this. Again, this was based on some aspects of sulfur chemistry, actually. And using that, we developed a new strategy, which worked out very, very well. And in the course of that, developed not only some new reactions that have been very useful generally, and that a lot of other people now have adopted this method in solving problems in their programs, but it was able to solve that particular problem in our program as well. So all discoveries aren't only made by accident. I mean, sometimes they are made by design out of necessity, where we couldn't resolve this problem by methods and procedures that existed, and we had to develop our own, and we were able to do so.
Was this a particularly good student?
Yes. The idea for the solution really did come from myself rather than the particular student. But again, like many other things involved in doing research, it comes during the interactions that I have with my students. You know, when we're sitting down, we're looking at the results, in which we're looking at not only the successes, but we're really spending most of our time on those aspects of the program that are not working, and just trying to figure out what's going wrong and what might we do to make it go right. And so, you know, you sit there and you talk, and during such conversations, this is where these kinds of ideas come out. So it's a give and take. And it was during one of these kinds of conversations that, you know, you suggest to him, saying, hey, you know, people have been able to do some kinds of things with this kind of reagent. If we were able to do a slightly different thing with that same reagent in your molecule, that we might be able to solve the problem. And he was, you know, a very, very good man, and was very excited about the prospects of trying such a new approach. And fortunately, is experimentally was very good and was able almost right off the bat to get it to work. And it again was a type of pioneering effort that initiated a large amount of research in our group. Mm-hmm. So it started or eventually ended up probably in work that led to several additional PhD theses, as well as the programs for several postdoctoral students. So it's the type of discovery that one would clearly define to be truly pioneering. Mm-hmm. But certainly at the time, we were just really trying to solve a problem. We weren't trying to discover something that was truly pioneering. But of course, when you do that, you're all the more happy about it. And that's what happened mm-hmm. there. We've had a number of cases where that has happened. One other area that we are working on, that we're still working on very heavily right now, an area that I am particularly excited about, deals with a type of reaction that is called cycloadditions. There is the very important Diels-Alder reaction. The Diels-Alder reaction is a approach that one uses to make certain kinds of rings, rings that contain six atoms. What we have been trying to do, I should back up a moment and simply say that of the various ways to make such rings, the Diels-Alder reaction is the most important. It has certain features that allows you to form these rings with an extreme degree of control. And it's the ability of doing it with such control that makes that reaction so extremely important. However, it is limited to being able to make only rings with six atoms. But for many of the kinds of molecules that one is interested in, you're interested in rings that have other numbers of atoms. Five atoms, four atoms, seven atoms, sometimes much larger, 15, 26, and people have even gone to much larger than that. And so what we have been trying to do is to ask the question as to whether we can develop a series of cycloaddition reactions to make rings other than six. And we started our work on making five. This area of five-membered rings came about because at the time, one, there were very few methods to make these kinds of rings, and two, as you begin seeing the large number of biologically important natural products, many of these compounds had as part of their structure rings containing five atoms. If one could have such a method to make such rings, then it would make the availability of not only these natural products, but just in general these classes of compounds, make them much more readily available and therefore more easily studied in order to explore more fully the properties of these materials, not only from the point of view of biology, pharmaceutical chemistry, for example, but also from a strictly chemical point of view as well. Now, in trying to do that, we brought together, by design, a whole bunch of different areas of research. In part, work that we were doing in our own laboratories, and in part, work that we were aware of that was going on in other laboratories. The part that was derived from our own research was related to these transition metal chemistry. The part that was derived from work that was going on in other laboratories around the world was related to the chemistry of silicon. Now, silicon is a very common element. It is the basic element that is found in sand, in the earth. The earth, the single most abundant element in the earth, not in the air above the earth, is in fact silicon. And it has an organic chemistry associated with silicon, where the silicon is bound to carbon. And when silicon is bound to carbon, we call this organosilicon compounds. And these have been an area of some study for organic chemists, and some very interesting chemistry has been evolving from that field of research. Well, from some ideas that came from the organic chemistry of silicon, and from ideas that came from our interest in transition metal chemistry, we were able to design de novo a new reaction. And it's one of the, I must say, one of the very few times where we actually sat down and designed a type of reaction that had literally no precedent. And not only design it, but it was successful.
Well, how? How did you do it?
Well, the only thing I can say is it was coming from trying to put together rather disparate facts in a reasonably rational fashion. And by being able to see the juxtaposition of two things that seemingly don't go with one another, and being able to bring those together and saying, well, what would actually happen if we brought this fact together with that one, even though they seem to have nothing to do with one another, maybe it could lead to something interesting. And that's really how we came about it. It was, again, a case where we were incredibly lucky in the sense that the student who was involved in this happened to be an exceptionally good student.
Who was it?
This was a man named Dominic Chan. He was born in Hong Kong. He had studied as an undergraduate in Canada and had come to Madison for his doctoral thesis. And as part of his doctoral thesis, he undertook this reaction, the study of this reaction, to develop it, to see whether it was a feasible reaction, and then to, in fact, extend it into a versatile method. And it was a case where we were able to make these compounds to test the reaction, not very well, I should say, in the beginning, but we were able to make enough of the compounds to be able to test them. And from the very beginning, we got initial success. And what he then was able to do is to take these initial successes and really build them into a very reliable success, a very reliable reaction, making them readily available and showing a generality. And this has evolved into a tremendous amount of effort in our own laboratories, and that, one can trace at least four subsequent PhD theses to this discovery. And I can't count how many how many postdoctoral students had programs that one way or another evolved from that initial discovery.
And what do you call it? How do you?
Well, this we call our TMM chemistry. This is trimethylene methane is the reactive intermediate that we are creating bound to a metal template. And what we do is have a reagent. Well, let me go back one moment. Trimethylene methane is not a compound that one can put into a bottle and just look at. It's something that has only a fleeting existence. So it can only exist in the absence of special restraints on the matter of nanoseconds. So that would be somewhere in the order of 10 to the minus 9th seconds. So very, very, very short times. However, if you can complex this to a metal, you can increase the lifetime of this intermediate. And this had been known in the literature, actually. People had made an iron complex of this reactive intermediate with the notion that by complexing it to the iron, one would be able to stabilize it. And by being able to stabilize it, then you perhaps could have some more useful chemistry that would ultimately result. They stabilized it so much that not only did it have a very long lifetime, so long that you could actually isolate it as a crystalline, discrete species, but it was totally devoid of reactivity. That means it wouldn't do anything. It would just sit there. So there's a case you went from a species that was so unstable that you could barely detect that it ever existed, all the way to the other extreme where it was so stable that you could no longer see chemical reactions from it. So what we did then was find, by using this new organosilicon chemistry, a totally different way to be able to generate these kinds of intermediates now on a broad range of metals, not just iron. And by using as the metal palladium to generate it in a form that was still reactive, so it would do do further chemistry like the cycloaddition reaction. And we now refer to this generally as our TMM palladium chemistry.
And this is quite recent, you said.
This is work that, in essence, was, reaching a reasonable level of success is just in the last couple of years. Hmm. And it's at a point now where it's still growing, though, in importance. But the real initial successes probably came a couple of years ago now, and one that we are building on. It is now, as an avenue of our immediate concern, is to take some similar idea and be able now to extend it to 7-membered rings, so that we can, instead of having a 3+2 cyclo addition to make 5-membered rings, we might be able to take these same trimethylene methanes, which are our 3-atom component, and condense them with a 4-atom component to make 7-membered rings. And that's an area of research that we're now involved in.
Are other people working on this too?
Oh, yes. As a result of our work, there has been some other work that has gone on using these kinds of reagents in other laboratories. There is also some related work dealing with non-silicon chemistry that people have also been able to carry out similar kinds of metal-catalyzed reactions. This is not the same, but similar. Mm-hmm. And there are very big differences between the actual specific results that one sees, although the overall process has a similar feature in that it involves a 3+2 cyclo addition to make a 5-membered ring. So that aspect is the same, but when you start looking at the specifics, those are very, very, very different. And in a sense, then, complements. One chemistry complements the other. And that always is very, very desirable to give you a broader spectrum of control and behavior.
So you're not feeling competitive with whatever lab it is that's doing that?
Well, you always feel somewhat competitive. I wouldn't say that we don't feel that there is a competition. We think there is. The competition is not in the sense that one person or the other person is really going to win and the other one lose.
Yeah.
Okay. Because, as I said, they do complement each other. But it's more the case as to which, in the end, will in fact be the more important, the more useful chemistry.
That's what I was wondering.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's a question that won't be answered for a very long time.
But presumably you think yours will be, because otherwise you wouldn't bother with it.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. We think our approach is the more rational.
What's the other lab?
The other lab is a lab in Germany. It is one at a Max Planck Institute in Mülheim.
This is tape 5 of the interview with Barry Trost.
The group that's involved, and it's a group that we interact with very strongly, and we exchange information, and we try to cooperate as much as possible. We have had one of the students in this lab in Germany, come to our laboratory and spend a year with us. So it's not a destructive type of competition. I mean, it's a very constructive type of competition, and we obviously try to we try to cooperate as much as possible. And we stay in contact with each other. When I'm in Germany, I try to stop by and find out the latest results that are going on in their laboratories. And when he is in the United States, he tries to stop by to find out what the latest results are in our laboratories, as well as, of course, staying in correspondence with each other. Mm-hmm. But there clearly is also a competition between us.
Is there any other development in your work recently?
Yeah, there's always things going on. Our program now, I think, has a certain amount of momentum on its own, in the sense that we have discovered a number of reactions, a number of reagents that require further understanding and further development. And that, of course, is a continuing activity. And the majority of the students in the group would be involved in activities of this kind. What I tend to do is to try to have my postdoctoral students get involved in the more speculative projects, and have my graduate students get involved in the somewhat less speculative projects, mm-hmm. because they have a thesis at stake, of course. We do hope that we can continue to make new discoveries, and we try to continue to design new reagents, new reactions, and this we are doing. It is still in the general areas of using transition metals, for example. It is in the general area of using sulfur chemistry, for example. It is in the general area of silicon chemistry, things that I've touched on in the past. Mm-hmm. We also try in our group to not only develop this new chemistry, but to see how this fits into the kinds of problems which are of contemporary importance. We, in that regard, look at what might be a class of molecule that would have some particular importance, either because it has some biological property or it has some interesting theoretical properties, and to then embark on using these newly developed reactions and reagents in order to solve the problems raised by these unusual important molecules. And fully half of my research group is involved in projects of this kind. Each one of those is a new enterprise in itself, but they have their origins in some of the underlying basic results that came from our methodology studies. But each one of these is a total entity unto itself, and it offers its own set of exciting challenges. What we find so commonly in that area of our research is a situation that I alluded to before when I spoke about one of our developments. I spoke about the development in our approach towards making an insect molting hormone and how that led to some discoveries in sulfur chemistry. Well, this happens many times. That is, we have, as I said, about half the group that is involved in doing these kinds of what we would call total syntheses. And when you do that, you have a notion of a problem that you're trying to solve based on some ideas that you generated from the methodology. But you always are all making a lot of assumptions, and those assumptions are based on literature precedent. But in synthesis, it's almost an art associated with how one carries out synthesis. It's not a strict science that you mix A with B and you always get C, just like when you are trying to make a complex sauce, or you're trying to make a complex dish. You have cook A who's making it, and you have cook B who's making it, and even though they seemingly mix together exactly the same ingredients, somehow the final product isn't the same. Well, the same thing happens in doing synthesis. You can have two people almost working side by side, mixing presumably together the same things, and they get quite different results. That's not an uncommon feature.
Can you explain it?
Yeah, you can explain it in the sense that there are so many variables that you must control that it's very, very hard to control all of them precisely. And furthermore, for the experimentalist to be so aware of these variables that they are even themselves realizing what the level of control that might be required. For, give you an a history lesson in what happened in one part of chemistry. There is a reaction that was known as the that is known as the Grignard reaction. Now, in this reaction, you take magnesium, which is a metal, and you react this in a certain way to generate a reagent that adds to ketones, to carbon-oxygen double bonds. Now, this reaction, which was discovered at the turn of the century, so it's quite an old reaction now, people found that when someone else tried to do the same reaction with a certain type of ketone, they got a totally different result than someone else. And nobody understood why, because they seemingly did exactly the same thing. Many, many years later, people began asking the question, well, I did the same thing as he did. Why did I get a different result? And they began trying to find out what could be the source of this. And they were able to check everything as carefully as possible. And eventually they found that the magnesium that this person had a very, very trace amount of copper in the magnesium as an impurity. He was totally unaware that it was present. And in those early days, it was not so easy to know that you would have such a small amount. And this guy, he had a much better quality magnesium. His magnesium didn't have that copper. And as a result of that presence of that copper, it totally changed the chemistry. Even though this copper was present only as a minor contaminant, that kind of thing is very easy to happen, where you always start out with chemicals, reagents, that you obtain from some source, but you never know precisely just how good a quality these are, whether they'll have other impurities in them, and whether those impurities, even present in such minute amounts that some of the most sophisticated methods we have for analyzing them may not detect the presence of these impurities, that they could totally alter the chemistry. So it's things like this that could lead to the differences. The other thing that could also lead to differences is just the common practice. One would think that common practice should be easily passed from one person to another. But you always have a person that they put a little bit of their own personality into everything that you do. Nobody's a robot that does everything precisely the same way. And this ability, this business of irreproducibility, even in a single person's hands, is still something that happens, too frequently.
Because you have to get rid of it eventually, don't you? I mean, it has to be reproducible.
In the end, if the science is going to be valid, it has to be reproducible. Mm. But it just simply points out that irreproducibility is not a rare occurrence. Mm-hmm. It happens many more times than we would like it to happen. And it just reveals our ignorance about what it is that can make a difference. It's just in part reflecting the personality. I had one student who just couldn't do anything. And it was just the way, no matter how much you would sit there and tell them how they should do things, they just had their own personality. And that just influenced every aspect of their behavior, even to the point of view of how they ran reactions. And although they seemingly went through the same motions as another person, they really didn't do things exactly the same way. That their personality was involved in how they did things, and it can change the chemistry. See, in chemistry, if you mix A with B, this can be very different than mixing B with A. Now, it doesn't sound like I said anything different. I said you mix A with B or B with A. But that could be a world of difference. You know, a very simple thing that one can learn at home that somebody might have easily experienced, if you take...
plenty of examples from cooking.
Oh, yes, plenty of examples from cooking. and plenty of examples from household cleaners where people have used acid, and if you add concentrated acid to water, this is safe. But if you add water to concentrated acid, you can have almost an explosion.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, just which way around? From something that is totally safe and harmless to something that can be extremely violent and dangerous. So all of these things come involved in doing any kind of synthesis. And people frequently refer to when they talk about synthesis, as the art and science, because it's not just science. There's a lot of art that's involved in trying to do synthesis. And that's one of the things that we hope we can minimize, but it's still very, very, very much a part of the science.
It sounds to me as if you'd have to get rid of any odd personalities. I mean, you'd have to control it in yourself if you were going to be a good chemist then.
Well, you have to not only get rid of the human characteristics of how people do things, but you also have to get rid of the inconsistencies of the reagents, the solvents that one constantly and commonly uses, because those are never controlled to the degree that may be necessary. Now, this doesn't mean that everything you always do always has this degree of sensitivity. All it does point out is that it can be a problem. And sometimes, more times than you'd like to admit, it is a problem.
You said that the things you're working on now are all related to earlier things you worked on and methods you discovered. Is there any chance that you might, have you thought at all of going in some very new direction?
Well, it's a hard thing to describe what does it mean when one says very new. This almost becomes a matter of definition. I felt, for example, that when we had decided to get involved in transition metal chemistry, that would represent a really radically new approach.
Yeah, I was just thinking of something you said when we talked before the interview. It had to do with Corona.
Right.
And saying that somebody might in fact move into another. But that's that's what you're talking about when you say you went into. All right, go ahead.
Yeah, I see what you mean. This relates to the point that I was raising as to what is totally new and what isn't totally new.
Mm-hmm.
Sure, one can imagine going into areas, for example, of molecular biology. That is, the differences between chemistry and molecular biology aren't so great. Molecular biology, by any rational analysis, is indeed chemistry. When you start saying it's molecular, well, molecules is chemistry. And what you're simply saying when you put molecular next to biology is that the world that we live in, the living world, is really a world of organized molecules, which when they're organized in certain ways, gives rise to life. And we are beginning to understand these molecular bases. And so it's not unreasonable that people involved in chemistry could begin involving themselves in research areas that would be related to various kinds of things of molecular biology. I don't see myself moving in that direction. It's impossible to say that I would never move in such a direction, because it certainly is an exciting area of science, and maybe someday I will. The National Science Foundation now has tried to encourage people, chemists especially, to involve themselves more in these types of areas, and they have established what they call a program entitled the Chemistry of Life Processes. And this is a blatant attempt to influence people, to say that we feel that these are some important areas, and we think it would be helpful if a larger fraction of chemists, or if some fraction of chemists, would worry about this area and try to solve some of the problems of this area. So it certainly is something that one could think about moving into. But there are other aspects of chemistry which are equally important, in my judgment, perhaps more important, something that I could contribute to more. And this is the area, the broad area that I deal with, and that is how one puts together in the laboratory complex molecules. Now, I will involve myself in some aspects, if you want, of molecular biology, biotechnology, because you can use enzymes, microorganisms, to operate on organic molecules, to carry out organic transformations. And so we will and have involved ourselves to a limited extent. Whether we'll get more involved in such an area, I don't know. I get involved in an area when I think I have something to contribute. If I don't have an idea, to simply recognize that there's an important area of research and to sort of flounder around in it doesn't get anywhere. If you can recognize an important area of research and have something to say, then it's worthwhile. For example, one area that sort of bridges between, let's say, biotechnology or molecular biology and more traditional chemistry would be the area of nucleic acids. Nucleic acids are the basic building blocks of DNA, RNA. Obviously, very, very important from the molecular biology point of view. This is an area that has not really enjoyed any modern thought, very, very little modern thought, in part because the kinds of problems were not so amenable, at least with the tools that were available. And while we were very well aware of the need for some developments, as early as the late 60s, when I was invited to participate in a NIH-sponsored workshop that was held at Stanford, dealing with this area of genetic chemistry, and pointing out to a group of, mainly at that time, young chemists from around the country that were viewed to be some of the brighter young people initiating their careers, and to say to them, hey, this is an important, exciting area. Why don't you think about it? Why don't you think about solving some of the problems here? And I would say of the group, there was maybe 10 of us that were involved. Only one initiated at that time a program in that area of research. And I think the person who did that did so more out of the feeling that this is an important area, and not out of the notion that they had anything to say about it. And in the end, was very unsuccessful. Had spent an inordinate amount of time and effort, manpower, with a shockingly little return.
Who was that?
I'd rather not say.
It must be in the literature.
Well, it's not in the literature because so little was accomplished that almost none of it made it to the literature. But it certainly was, I mean, people know about it in the field, but it's something that people would rather forget about rather than say put it as a permanent record. But it's just something that can happen. In our own case, we didn't feel we really had much to contribute. We didn't have an idea. Sure, we can recognize and say that, well, perhaps that really is an important area. You know, we can be convinced of that. But that's not enough. Now we're almost 20 years later, and based on some of our transition metal chemistry, we've come back and said, hey, you know, we might have something to say about that. And so we've initiated a program that is related to genetic chemistry. And we're making a little headway. We've gotten some really nice early results. They aren't yet at a stage that we're ready to publish them, but they look encouraging enough that I have started a second student on following up the initial results that a former postdoc had made. So I am optimistic. that we might be able to make a contribution now and not spend an inordinate amount of time just floundering around trying to find something that we had an idea. And the idea, in part, came from our understandings and developments that happened in the interim. And just thinking back that, gee, you know, they pointed out some of these problems way back then, and maybe we can say something about them then. And it's still a maybe, but I think the question mark is becoming more of an exclamation point. And maybe it will become an exclamation point. We'll see. So, yeah, we are initiating areas, but I don't consider that, for us it's a new area, but I don't consider that to be a totally, you know, a totally different direction.
No, but that's, I would consider it a new area too, from what you say.
Yeah. So, as I say, you know, it's always, there are always shades of these kinds of things as to what represents these kinds of judgments. There's a certain uneasiness in chemistry today where people feel that you must really be involved in things that people feel are more molecular biology if you're going to be looking for the future. And I feel rather sad when people feel that that represents the major challenges. Not that I would deny that these are some major challenges, but I would also feel very strongly that there are many other equally significant major challenges that has nothing to do whatsoever with molecular biology. We, when I talk of our work in transition metal chemistry, I frequently refer to these catalysts as the chemist's enzymes. I put those in quotes. And I have been roundly criticized by some people for using such a term because they say it's an abuse of the term. Enzyme has a very specific meaning, has very specific structures. You're not dealing with those kinds of structures, therefore you shouldn't use the term. I think that's a rather narrow, short-sighted perspective because enzymes aren't just a structure, they're also a concept. They are a concept of selectivity of an inordinate degree. And they are a catalyst that expresses this type of selectivity to an inordinate degree. And in that context, then I think enzymes represent something beyond just proteins, just a specific kind of structure. And if one is willing to give me, say, that latitude, then the term I'm using is quite appropriate. And so
it's enzymologists, presumably, who object to your using the
not
term.
Not necessarily. Some of my fellow chemists object to that. Enzymologists certainly would object, but chemists object to that notion, again, for reasons that they like to be very strict. They like to have a word mean a very single thing, and not to be broadened into a general class. So in that sense, they don't like to be like like someone who's writing a novelist, which will generate illusions of by using a word from a different area in a totally different context to sort of drum up an image in the reader's mind to make a point. Well, chemists,
this is a very useful device of words.
Oh yes, it's a very dramatic way for being able to present ideas, and I think it's a very constructive way because it's one that also stimulates the enthusiasm, excitement, and imagination. So for this reason, I think chemists should not be so restrictive. I mean, it certainly is part of our language that this is a common feature in literature to do such things, and I think science could also benefit by using similar kinds of approaches.
Would you be accused of trying to use a vogue word?
Yes. This would be another statement that people would feel that you are trying to sell something more than it really is.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
But you don't feel you're doing that?
No, I guess what I'm trying to do is to get more the notion that selective catalytic activity is not a property restricted to proteins. That's the notion I'm trying to get across and why I use the term.
Have you given a paper on it? Or do you go that far?
I have not given a, well, I have presented lectures where I have used this in the title.
Mm-hmm.
And I have also on, I guess, one or two occasions have written reviews dealing with what I felt are some of the exciting challenges in chemistry, and have used this term, mm-hmm. obviously in quotation marks. So I have employed it on several occasions, and
this is what would interest a philosopher of science, wouldn't it?
Yes.
I mean, have you ever discussed it with
any
of the philosophers?
No. No. I think language is an awfully important part of doing science, and it's something I've been also criticized for, because I take more leeway with language than some of my colleagues would like, and they accuse me of inventing words, and what they really mean is not inventing words, but using words that good English words, but have not been used in a particular context. So I have generated a number of terms, because I think language should facilitate communication of ideas. If you have to go through a half-hour explanation of a concept, where if you use one word, you can say the same thing, it seems to me it's worthwhile to introduce a word rather than going through a long explanation. The purpose of language is to facilitate communication between people, to make them understand each other. The danger, of course, is that you create a lot of jargon. So it's always a trade-off between how much jargon you create, and therefore a specialist can only talk to specialists and they can't talk to anybody else. To the other extreme of not introducing such terms and thereby making the communication awfully complicated and awfully tedious. So you have to reach balance. But okay.
But
I tend to be accused of using too many new words rather than the other. So people feel I do it too much. Maybe I do. I don't know. I guess I don't really think about it so much, in the sense that I don't feel that it is such a bad thing to do.
Are there precedents for this in people that you admire in chemistry, science,
oh,
generally?
Oh, yes. There certainly are precedents for the introduction of terms to describe concepts that had not been used before. The area of stereochemistry, for example, has introduced a whole vocabulary into the science prior to, well, that's hard to say, but certainly it was in the 1940s and 1950s that people really began understanding stereochemistry. And as a result of that, they didn't have good ways of really describing these things. And Prelog at the ATH, a very, very well-known, extremely important chemist who was recognized for his contributions by a Nobel Prize, introduced a whole vocabulary in this area, but did more than that. He introduced a whole set of conventions in order to help describe this. So the idea of introducing words to help describe phenomena that were not clearly understood or recognized previously is not new. Obviously, as science progresses, and as it progresses, it's going to have to find ways to be able to communicate the new concepts and techniques. And that's something that has to be done. It's when a science stops progressing, then the need for doing this would cease. And for this reason, I think a chemist would be better off recognizing that this is helpful rather than harmful. And the fact that many of the terms that I have introduced have been widely adopted tell me that people feel that there's a need. They start using the same terms. So there are, not everybody is critical. And some people mm-hmm. find that it is helpful, and being helpful, they then use it as well. But in part, a language also helps set a tone for what represents important problems. I've said on a number of occasions now, selectivity and synthesis is what I view to be the thrust of the kinds of things that we worry about. So that no matter what aspect of our program that I look at, if you want to say there is a common thread, that is the common thread. And it carries, but it's such a broad concept that almost anything that one can do can, one way or another, find its way as being legitimately a subcategory of that area. Mm-hmm. So, I think it's an important aspect. Where we should go next?
One little thread or tail. Do you lose students, do you think? Is chemistry losing them to the more glamorous science of molecular biology?
I think the answer to that is yes. That chemistry as a science, let me say that any science, not just chemistry, goes through periods of tremendous growth and periods where things have slowed down. Physics has gone through that, these cycles. Chemistry has been on such a tremendous growth curve for so long that people forget that there inevitably is going to be a period where things have to slow down. And we are clearly in that period right now. One doesn't have an easy way of quantifying these kinds of things. You can start looking at the numbers of students graduating from universities with degrees in chemistry and see that at various levels, bachelor's, master's, PhD, and see that there has been a decline from, let's say, 1960 to 1985. But on the other hand, you could say that the periods of the 1960s was just unrealistically high, and that we're now back to a more reasonable level.
Well, there was an article recently, I guess, in Science magazine about the funding of chemistry, which apparently is way, way below that for physics, and mm-hmm. particularly, I guess. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, this is part of the Pimentel report.
Working on how to remedy it.
Right. Well, this is all part and parcel of the same thing, I think. It's a general perception that chemistry, in the funding mechanism, that chemistry doesn't have the same kinds of exciting frontiers as it did perhaps 20 or 30 years ago, and that the more exciting frontiers are in other areas. Unfortunately, there have been some leading chemists who have been exponents of just that philosophy. And as I mentioned before, I think this is clearly a very short-sighted perspective, and one that is, in my judgment, much more telling of the individual and their lack of understanding. Their lack of their own personal enthusiasm for new areas that they, perhaps for whatever reasons, don't see what can represent a new and exciting challenge in chemistry. And as a result of that, have felt, well, if I can't see the new and exciting challenges, there must not be any. This is a very common human weakness, to want to associate a whole area with oneself. And that can become very illusory as far as what really is a state of affairs in the science. What one has certainly seen for chemistry is that it has never had any kind of step-out funding. Now, what one means by that is that back in the 1950s, when the federal government got involved in funding science in a big way, it set up a funding base for the various disciplines. And they more or less would say grew almost in lockstep. That is, the relative order didn't change. They all grew, including chemistry. But they all grew at about the same rate. At various points in time, however, you can show, for example, in physics, with especially things like these, what is called big physics, when you have to build these mammoth types of resources, these accelerators, etc. You can show that there have been discontinuous jumps in funding, you know, where a decision was made to build Batavia, for example, or other kinds of these big facilities where you need a large, large increment. And that was added on to, not in place of, the existing funding. That's certainly happening in molecular biology, biotechnology right now, that it is so much perceived to be the wave of the future that it is getting a discontinuous amount of funding increase. Chemistry, for whatever reasons in the early days of the history of the federal funding, did not have an adequate base relative to the size of the community, relative to the economic importance of the science. Of the various sciences, chemistry has to stand very high, if not the top, in terms of its economic importance to the country at large, to the standard of living, improvements in health care, improvements in the materials that go into manufacturing everything from electronics to clothes to houses to cars to streets to whatever you want to call, name it. Almost all of these developments, somewhere along the line, had as a critical element a chemical base. The new materials that have been created due to developments in chemistry have provided the locomotive for all of these things. If you take that into account, and then you look at what fraction of monies are spent at the federal level for supporting this rather underlying science, it was clearly underfunded from the very beginning. The one thing you could say, though, is that in those days, there was such a substantial amount of funding relative to the community at large that everybody more or less had enough money. So in the late 1950s, 1960s, nobody really looked into these questions very seriously because more or less there was enough to satisfy everybody. In the 1970s, things changed. The rate of growth of the funding support did not match at all the rate of growth of the sciences. So then funding starts getting pretty tight. And when it gets tight, then people begin realizing how underfunded the science really is. So it's not so much that today it is more underfunded than it was way back then. Relative to the other sciences, it was already very badly underfunded way back then. But it was a big enough pie that it didn't hurt anybody. Today, that ratio is probably still there. Chemistry actually has shrunk somewhat, actually. Not a large amount, but it has shrunk somewhat. But the amount is so small relative to the opportunities and the community that it's really hurting. And that's why people have been so anxious to really get the message across that there are major opportunities to be had, and that the lack of funding is the single most important source of retarding progress. This has all kinds of spillovers. For example, certainly even in the case of where students go, if it is perceived from a general point of view that there are exciting things happening in chemistry, and this comes essentially starts with places like NSF or NIH or DOD, which are the major funding sources, so that they are convinced to the point that they start putting more of their funds into these areas. This has a snowballing effect and will indeed affect students in making their own career decisions. Right now, the public press seems to say that if you're going to look to the future, you better either do computer science or molecular biology or biotechnology, yeah. That there is no future anywhere else.
Well,
that's unfortunate, because that certainly is not true.
A statement I had down to ask you about, which fits in here, was somebody's to the effect that, well, he was saying chemistry is called completely commercialized, but he was disagreeing with it. That would certainly give chemistry a bad name.
Well,
on the whole.
Yeah,
commercialized
in the sense that the products of chemistry can be brought to solving problems of society in a relatively short time scale. It certainly is true. I don't see anything wrong with that. I think that society at large should be able to benefit from the fruits of scientific endeavor. And if one can see that chemical research can provide practical solutions to problems, that's what we're looking for from science. So I don't take that as a dirty word to say that something's commercialized. I think we live in a real world, and the only way you can bring the benefits of society to society is to recognize that somebody, somewhere along the line, is going to have to be willing to take the risk to try to develop that into a final product, to do all the adequate development that the society demands to show that it's safe, that it really does what people say it does, and that it can be distributed, disseminated widely without causing any adverse effects. Now, that's not a trivial thing to do, and the costs involved are not trivial. Nobody's going to make a discovery in the laboratory today and then tomorrow have it out on the street peddling it for somebody to use. That's just not the world we live in. And one of the problems we certainly have had in the past has been the lack of appreciation of the tremendous complexities associated with doing what is seemingly the simplest thing. I think it would have been hard to realize the idea of just throwing away a bottle has a lot of implications when you have 200 million people throwing away a bottle. Okay, and certainly in the 1800s and 1900s, people never, or the early 1900s, thought about the notion that throwing away a bottle could create a problem. We certainly think about it today. Things as simple as that, which look totally innocuous, that makes the development or the translation of a discovery into a useful product very, very, very expensive. And that's what commercialization means. Some people think commercialization simply means making a profit. Well, obviously,
I suspect that's what was.
I think that's what they mean there too, but I guess I don't think anybody's going to take a risk unless they think that they're going to be able to make a profit. Mm-hmm. We can't. It's not reasonable to expect that government is going to do all these things. There's little question that if you look around the world to see where the society at large has been better off in being able to take advantage of the fruits of science, places where the government totally controls things are not those are not the places where the society has benefited the most. So, yeah, somebody's going to make a profit, and that seems to be a necessary consequence in order to really carefully and truly test what represents a useful development and what represents a foolhardy development. And people really start thinking hard before they start engaging today in going through that very long, time-consuming, costly experiment of bringing something to market.
But that's not your concern anyway,
that's
is it?
That's not my concern at all. But I don't think there's anything wrong with that. I think it is an appropriate avenue for science. And certainly chemistry is a science that has this kind of more immediate type of thing. But even there, when you say more immediate, you're not talking about days. You're talking about years. You know, you can talk about 10 years between the initial discovery, saying, hey, we have something that we think can really be useful, and the time in which it would be first really introduced into the marketplace. Not making a profit, mind you, just being introduced. So it's a very, very complicated world we live in. The only way I get involved is that I do talk with chemical industry. I am a consultant
with chemical industry.
And I know what their concerns are and how they try to go about solving problems and going through the discovery process. So it is very, very intriguing, actually, and very important. Right now, I think the thing where this commercialization is much closer to the scientific establishment at universities. In chemistry, the commercialization is not really very close to the establishments in universities. One can say more clearly, and this isn't completely the case, but you can say more clearly that there is a separation between, you know, really basic research which has no commercial goals in mind going on at universities, relative to the tremendous amount of research that goes on in industry, that there is a large industrial base of research in chemistry. But that's more at the development end, doing what they would call basic research, but basic research much more oriented towards a product, a service, a material that can be sold, that would have certain kinds of properties, uses. In the area of biotechnology, where there isn't such industry, yet the feeling that there really are these practical things, you see a lot more of that, quote, commercialization being done in universities, because you don't have that resource base in industry. Yeah. Yes, it's being created, and being created at a phenomenal clip, but still, you'll see at many, many universities, academic laboratories, where the kind of research that's going on is very much geared to the idea that there can, in fact, be a practical commercial product that would result. So I do hope that in the end we can all benefit from these kinds of developments.